Hi, I'm Shireen Smith, and my guest today on the Brand Tune podcast is Robin Lander, Distinguished Professor at Keene University and the author of 25 books. Her books focus primarily on creativity and include titles such as Graphic Design Solutions, Build Your Own Brand, and Thinking Creatively in the Digital Age. Among other things, she's a graphic designer who is highly knowledgeable about branding and creative thinking. So I'm really excited she will be delivering a 10-minute masterclass for us on strategic creativity before the interview part of the podcast. Hello, Robin. I understand you've got some slides, so do you want to share them now?
Yes, thank you so much, Shireen. I really appreciate it. Great. Can you see my screen okay?
Yeah. Yes, perfect.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. I'm a major fan of yours.
Oh, thank you.
So you're welcome. A little bit about strategic creativity and brand identity. So I'm the author of 25 books about design and creativity, ideation, graphic design, branding, personal branding. And today I'm going to talk about designing brand identity, but creatively and particularly strategically creatively, because there is a difference. Brand identity is the representation of a brand transmedia, a concept, a story, the brand essence that has to resonate with the audience, has to authentically communicate, and it makes a brand memorable and distinctive. And it really should connect emotionally with people at every touch point 360. So first we think about the brand construct. What is the brand? What do people want from the brand? What do they need? And we have to think about it both in the present and in the near future, perhaps in the long term. What's the brand story? And that has to be a lodestar story that carries through. How does the brand fit into what people want, as well as what we anticipate they might appreciate? How are the brand attributes portrayed as distinctive in a very crowded, and I didn't put this in the slide, but an international marketplace? Mm-hmm. Oops, sorry about that. And then there's the brand manifesto, which not everybody is that familiar with, which started out as an internal document to kind of energize everybody on the brand side, but then people found that it worked really well externally. I think Avis Rental Car was the first to launch their external brand manifesto. And that's a creative aspirational declaration of intent. It transcends the corporate mission, but it aligns with the brand's and the company's values and principles. And basically, it started out, and it still is, a motivational statement that positions the brand on an emotional plane. I'm just going to go back to the brand manifesto for a second. It can be visual. So, for example, the brand Lululemon, an athletic wear brand, has a visual brand manifesto that's all over their packaging. And it can be written as well. The brand design concept, which is critical because it has to drive all of the applications, it's the creative reasoning. It's the intention underlying all the brand communication. The North Star brand design concept must align with the brand story. Otherwise, it will confuse people. It has to drive every decision about color palette, graphic design, imagery, copy, typography, art direction, even extending into the advertising, motion, because everything today moves, right, digitally, voice, sound. I'll talk about sonic branding in a moment. And of course, now we're in the metaverse, so it has to work across virtual reality, augmented reality, gaming, wherever people interact, both digitally and physically with the brand. And many brands think about scent as well. So, for example, if you go into a store or a hotel, there may be a distinctive scent that is part of the brand. And the brand identity, people think of it as, often think of it as a logo or a logo mark, but it's much more. It's every representation of the brand essence and its strategic position in the marketplace. The logo may be the entry point. American designer Milton Glaser says it is the entry point into a brand identity, but it is not the only element by far of a brand identity. So a brand identity obviously identifies, it must be distinctive in order to be memorable. So we want it to be memorable, but it won't be memorable unless it's distinctive. It also has to differentiate the brand in a very crowded marketplace. It has to be appropriate for both the brand and the audience. So we have to think about it on both sides. It should be aspirational. People should think of it as part of their aspirational thinking. And if possible, it should emotionally imprint on people. We always want to look for that emotional branding.
Sorry to step in, Robin. There's a really an interference in the sound, which makes it quite difficult to hear the sound. So I thought we might be better off starting again and rather than continue, because it's very
okay.
Can you not hear it yourself?
I hear something, and it might be the computer running hot.
Yeah, it's when you talk, it makes the noise.
Let me disconnect from my mic and see if the computer mic is better. Should we try that?
No, it's still continuing, the sound.
I didn't do that yet. I'm going to disconnect from the external mic. And is that any better?
Yeah.
It is better?
Yeah, it's completely gone, the noise.
So should I start again? I'm sorry.
Yeah, please, if you go back to the very start, and then we can cut out this bit.
Okay. Hello, thank you so much, Shireen, for having me. I'm a major fan of yours. It's an honor to be here with you today. Thank you. I'm going to talk about strategic creativity as it relates to brand identity. I'm the author of 25 books about branding, graphic design, creativity, ideation, personal branding. I also hold the title of Distinguished Professor in the Michael Graves College at King University. So brand identity has to be creative, and it has to be strategically creative in order to gel with the target audience. A brand identity is the representation of a brand transmedia, a concept, it's a brand story, it's the essence that resonates with the audience, authentically communicates, and it's what makes a brand memorable and distinctive. And hopefully it connects emotionally with people at every touch point, 360. The brand construct is what we start out with to understand what a brand is, what people want from the brand, what it can offer them, how the brand fits into what people want, as well as anticipate what they might appreciate. Most importantly, it aligns with the brand story, how the brand attributes are portrayed as distinctive in a very crowded commercial arena. Or nonprofit arena as well. The Brand Manifesto, which is a document or an iteration that a lot of people aren't as familiar with as the brand construct. The Brand Manifesto is a creative aspirational declaration of intent. It started out as an internal communication within a company to energize employees and everyone. Now it goes externally. People found that it was very useful. It can be visual. So for example, Lululemon, the athletic wear brand, has a visual brand manifesto that is on their packaging and their website. It transcends the corporate mission, but aligns with the values and principles of the company. It's a motivational statement that positions the brand on an emotional plane. And very importantly, there has to be a concept underlying the brand identity. It should be a lodestar concept, a North Star concept. It's the intention underlying all the brand communication. It has to absolutely align with the lodestar brand story, with the core brand story. And for designers and art directors working on the brand identity, it has to drive every decision they make about color palette, graphic design, copy, typography, art direction as it extends into advertising, motion, voice, sonic branding, which I'll talk about. And of course, now we're in the metaverse, so it has to extend into virtual reality, augmented reality, gaming. And many brands have a scent. So if you go into their brick and mortar storefront, or if you go into a hotel, there may be a scent that they pipe in that you'll associate with the brand. The brand identity is the representation of the brand and its strategic position in the marketplace. And it's every representation of the brand. A lot of people say that, think of the brand identity as a logo, but it is much, much more. Milton Glaser, American designer, said that the logo is the entry point for the brand, but every touch point 360 with people is part of the brand identity. And of course, it obviously has to identify. And in order to do that, it must be distinctive. It must be memorable. It needs to differentiate the brand from other brands in the category. It has to imprint on people. We have to really remember it in every way, so that if you say the brand name, the imagery comes to mind, or the sound comes to mind, the sonic branding comes to mind. It should be appropriate for the brand and for people, for the audience, and it should be aspirational, in line with people's, the target audience's aspirations. And hopefully it emotionally imprints, because emotional branding is really critical. The logo is the, technically designers think of a logo as the mark. The name spelled out in unique typography is the logo type, but everybody casually refers to the mark or the logo type as a logo. And it's any typeface that used needs to have a distinctive visual voice for that brand. And that voice, that visual voice, is expressed by the particular characteristics of the specific letter forms. So to appreciate the design of a typeface, people find this fascinating once they realize it, is that if you look at the shape of the letter forms, the inherent balance in the design of each letter of the alphabet, the proportions, the axis, meaning the slant of letters, the characteristics of the letter forms, shapes, the open spaces inside letters, which we call the counters, the detailing of the serifs, the shape of the serifs or lack of serifs, sans serifs. And here's just some letter O's to show you differences in how the inside the counter shape changes the appearance of a letter form, and whether the letter form is is uniformly thick, or if it's thick and thin, if it's a perfectly round O or an oval O, all of that affects us. We don't realize it, but it does affect people, and it does represent the brand. Any logo mark, meaning a symbol, any imagery should communicate quickly. It should work well, small and large. It has to be on a business card, and it has to be perhaps on the side of a building. It has to be a coherent unit and work as an independent unit so that it can move around independently and not be linked to anything. It has to be appropriate, of course, expressive, and relevant to the brand construct and the audience. When we design, all designers learn basic design principles, and those come into play in designing a logo. We think, and all elements of the brand identity. These are the major principles that we think about. It has to be balanced, and balance is the one thing that most people, when they start studying design, can almost feel intuitively, because we seek balance in our lives, the way we organize things in our homes. Visual hierarchy, what we want people to see first, second, and third, that's critical for any designer to understand and for a logo to have. It must be unified. There should be some rhythm and flow with how we see it, just the way there's rhythm in music. The shape relationships of the logo should be interesting. These positive shapes, which are the image themselves, as they relate to the background, what we call the negative shapes. It should have interesting form. If it's not interesting, we won't remember it and we won't look at it to begin with. And then there are issues of space. There's graphic space, which is the flat two-dimensional space of the digital page or the printed page. And then we can create the illusion of three-dimensional space in a logo or in a mark. The designer also has to think about how we pair type and image. And there are three basic ways to think about that. The typeface should either share characteristics with the image, or it should contrast the image's characteristics. That's unusual. The typeface, and the typeface can be neutral, meaning it allows it's a classic neutral face that allows the image to be the hero or the star. The middle one, the contrasting characteristics, is the most unusual. And when we pair type and image, a logo mark with the logo name, either the type should dominate or the image should dominate. If they're both screaming for our attention, it will be less memorable and we won't know where to look first. The color palette usually has a dominant hue. One of the colors is dominant, and then the others are secondary or tertiary. There are color associations. What most people don't realize is that color is not universal. We have to be very careful when color is used internationally. It has to work in context. When you see colors outdoors as opposed to indoors, on screen versus on printed paper, color works differently. You have to really think about differentiating color from the competition so that it's not confusing, especially when it comes to things like consumer goods that are sitting on a supermarket shelf. How do you know what to look for? Colors are used as cues also in packaging. So we all know that we're looking for lemon, or we're looking for decaffeinated. Color helps us with that. And of course, we think about, as I said, digital, print, and the audience. Sonic branding is very interesting, because in the digital realm, we can use sound really easily. When if you turn on your telly and you're going to start to watch a program, there may be a sound associated with the channel, with the media channel, the streaming channel that you're watching. And immediately it says to you, yes, I know what I'm about to see. And it kind of could spark an emotion in you as well. I think I read a survey saying that in the UK, Just Eat is the most popular Sonic branding. McDonald's has a very distinctive one. Intel, you know, Intel is inside. It's a cue. Gary Vaynerchuk, who owns VaynerMedia, and he's a big media star, and he used to own a wine company, says that sound is incredibly powerful because of the speed at which you can capture your audience's attention and cement your brand in their minds. Sound has a powerful ability to trigger specific emotions and memories, and that's impactful when it comes to branding. And then there's the metaverse. A lot of us are a little confused about the metaverse, and it's in its infancy. It will become the next, I think, iteration of computing and the internet. It's kind of a combination of physical and digital worlds, but we all have digital personas. So the brand has a digital persona. It also has to exist now in virtual worlds and in virtual reality. Augmented reality combines the digital and physical worlds. And if a brand exists in gaming, so for example, I don't know if you have Wendy's in the UK, but Wendy's is a fast food chain. They've been active inside gaming, inside of a game such as Fortnite. A lot of brands are now hitting gaming audiences by playing with them inside brands. And just to round this whole thing out, what brand identity does is really builds a world. It builds an imaginary world, just the way a film director or a screenwriter or a novelist, you know, you think about the world of Harry Potter, the wonderful imaginary world that she built, where everything is new and fresh, and it has to be believable in context and in every touch point. And every touch point, every time we come in contact, whether it's with a truck or a package or a logo or a business card, that builds the brand and builds the brand story for us. And within the world, there is a system of rules and guidelines that govern the entire brand identity system. And when designers create a brand identity, they actually give this guideline system to the brand so that they know what to do and what not to do. And it's given out to their employees who have any contact with changing the, you know, creating corporate communications and with the ad agency who's creating advertising. Every time someone comes in contact with a brand touch point, that connection should help build the brand story. And it shouldn't be a cut and paste. It shouldn't be the same thing, but little different pieces of the brand story all add up to building the world. And there's style. People think about style in a variety of ways. We all think about style. We understand it in terms of fashion, but there is style in brand identity as well. And it's a visual look and feel based on all the characteristics, all the visual and sound characteristics that go into developing the brand identity: typefaces, color palette, textures, patterns, how you compose the imagery, the kinds of images, whether they're illustrations or it's motion graphics or it's photography, what kind of illustrations. Every graphic element contributes transmedia to the style. And it has to be distinctive. Again, that word distinctive keeps coming up because it has to differentiate, it has to be identifiable. Hopefully it's unique and fresh because style does express. And that's it for me.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
So in my experience, designers very readily change the visual identity of brands. So when do you think, say, so you were saying the design concept and is the North Star, so I assume that's based around your brand promise or whatever you've decided is going to be that central essence of the brand or whatever word you want to use. if that changes, is it then appropriate to change all the visual identity?
Great, great point. Absolutely, yes. And times change, right? We're living in rapidly changing times. You can think about, I don't know if you have burger, I keep making all these fast food references. I'm sorry, I don't even eat that stuff, but Burger King has changed their brand identity, I think, 3 times in the last 10 years. And you might not even notice the slight variations, but they're there. And you're right, if the story changes, if the brand construct changes, if the promise changes, depending on what people want, and being nimble, moving with the times, yes, absolutely. The brand identity should be refreshed. Sometimes it's refreshed, meaning they tweak it. Mm-hmm. It's not an entire, they keep some of the equity, some of the value. They might usually keep a color, the main color, but they'll tweak the type. The typography is what often changes to refresh it, because believe it or not, typefaces go in and out of vogue. Yeah. And if you look at the history of advertising, you can see typefaces that are used in very popular ones throughout advertising. And that gives you a clue as to what's on trend.
Yeah. So there's a complete radical change so that you almost wouldn't recognize a brand anymore. Or there's sort of making adjustments, like Burger King, I think, is still very recognizably the same brand, but it's just a little bit tweaked, which presumably has reasons behind it design wise. But to the public, you know, somebody looking at it, they wouldn't think, you know, who is this? Which brand is this? So I'm just wondering when it would be appropriate for a brand to just completely change and, you know, have a different font, have a different color, just completely be made to look different.
Well, often a brand merger will necessitate that.
A what?
A brand merger, when companies, let's say two oil companies join, yeah, or streaming companies join, or two publishers join, that often necessitates a complete change. Or if they really feel that they're dated, that they're no longer viable in today's market, that people think of them as old. So, you know, a certain car brand might be your grandfather's car brand, right? And now they want to hit a new audience. Mm-hmm. Or they want to expand their audience. So I think that it really has to do with, there's so many variables, but to throw out all the equity is unusual. Because as you said, you don't want to have to completely reintroduce the brand, mm-hmm, unless that's your point, that you're saying, hey, look, we're completely new. I'm a new entity.
Yeah, sort of new name, new everything. Right. Which I think the Ehrenberg Bass Institute has highlighted the dangers of rebranding. I think not just them, I think it's just generally known, I think, that it's not a good idea to rebrand, even if there's been some major incident for the company, you know, throwing away the brand equity and changing the look and feel of the brand doesn't, you know, seem to be a good idea. But I'm just wondering why designers in the small business market, I have noticed again and again, they'll just totally scrap everything and start again with something totally new. And I'm thinking, if they understand visual language, if they understand that this matters, why are they so ready to throw it out and then start afresh when, you know, you would expect them to respect it more, if you like, rather than less?
I think it depends on the owners and the board as to whether they really understand what the equity is. And I think people don't realize that there's comfort for audiences in something that they know. I don't have to reintroduce, it's sort of like, hello, I'm so and so. Nice to meet you. you know, you bring that element. And of course, designers want, I mean, we want to make money. So talking your client into redoing it might work. And maybe it's just really bad. You know, I often, when I teach branding, I have my students go look for a really ugly brand identity that we can redo, because some of them are just, you know, if you really think about the ones that win awards, it's the top 1%. Most are really hideous.
And so how can you tell when a brand identity is hideous? Do you have any examples of brand identities that have been, you know, not suitable at all?
I don't know if you have them in the UK. Do you have Trident chewing gum?
No. No. Probably. I mean, it's just, or, I've heard the name Trident chewing gum.
Or Ace Hardware is awful. I mean, and they're both good products, good services. So it's really a matter of, you know, taste. And I should have put that in my presentation, because taste is something that, you know, you use in your home.
Yeah.
But it should have nothing to do, your taste and your client's taste should have nothing to do with the brand. It has to do with the company, the brand of the company and the audience. Taste is out of it. But sometimes clients impose their taste on designers. I've fired clients where I just couldn't work with them anymore, because what they wanted was just not doing them a service. And it was just, I didn't want it in my portfolio. I have friends who fired clients. Clients put a very heavy hand in it sometimes. Sometimes you'll have a great client who lets you run with it. Or they'll go to a top design firm or branding firm, and then they'll trust that firm, but you're paying that firm for their expertise. Let them do what they like. But I think, why do we have so much television programming or movies are pedestrian? Mm. It's very hard to do something brilliant.
And is a designer, graphic designer, automatically able to do identity, or should you choose designers who have been trained in brand identity? I mean,
great question. Yeah. At the university, we do teach brand identity, but it usually is a specialty. There are great firms that specialize in that. And now when you train as a graphic designer at university, you're learning communication design, promotional design, logo design, corporate communication design. So you're leaving usually as a generalist. And where you get your job really kind of trains you. So there are book jacket designers who specialize. There are brand identity designers who specialize. There are people who design PowerPoint presentations or Google Slide presentations, because that takes particular expertise. Some people are great at everything, but I think most big companies go to a firm that specializes in identity design, or what a lot of people are now calling identity or brand experience design, because every touch point is an experience.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand every touch point matters and it all needs to tie in together, but there's something I don't quite get about how you translate the brand strategy into a visual identity. And presumably lots of designers could come up with different ideas, or would they all think, okay, this typography is right for this brand that wants to be accessible, say? You know, how do you decide on that an accessible brand needs a certain look, for example?
If I assign a logo design brand identity to my class, I would say that 70% of them, and I teach very, very talented people, mm-hmm. will come up with a similar concept for the first go around.
Uh-huh.
because they're all thinking, oh yes, bakery, it should look yummy, it should have an aroma, it should, you know, you're thinking along very pedestrian common lines. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and then the top 30% will come up with very different, unusual, unique takes on it because of how they're thinking and how strategically creative they are. But then that other 70 will push it further. And so, you know, your first draft, your first thinking is often something that a lot of other people are thinking about. And then you really have to learn to push your thinking further. And we train them to do that. We train them to, my system is that I have a system called the 3 G's, mm-hmm. which is goal, gap, and gain. And so we think about the goal, the main goal of the communication. The gap is what's missing. It could be a lack of understanding about something. It could be a missing piece in the marketplace. It could be how we differentiate. It could be not really understanding the audience. So we're looking for a gap that our idea can fill. And then ultimately the third G is a gain. What's the gain? What are people going to get from this? What's the benefit in them, for them? Is it functional? Is it emotional? And so when you think about the goal, the gap, and the gain, and you put them together, it kind of pushes you strategically to think more creatively.
Yeah. Would you show the target market examples of designs to see if it resonates with them, or is that not a consideration?
Yes, they do that. Sometimes it will kill it. Sometimes it will kill creativity because people will tell you, you know, well, I'm sure you know a lot about focus groups. They might tell you what they think you want to hear, or they have pedestrian ideas about it. I mean, sometimes that kills the most creative concepts, and it brings it down to a more middle level. But yeah, I mean, I think research is good to do before, mm-hmm. to really find out what people are interested in, what they want, and to do a lot of social listening, to go on social media, go on Twitter, go on Instagram. Listen to the pain points, listen to what people think, listen to their perceptions, right? Perception becomes reality. What are they complaining about? What do they like? What don't they like? What other brands do they like? So I always train my students, and I do it myself, to really listen to what people are saying on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, design is just so hugely important but it operates on an emotional level. I'm not sure how much research is done to actually understand whether this typeface creates this emotional response or what. Does it exist?
Yes, academics do a lot of that. There are, I don't know if you're familiar with the design community, but the people who are typographers are very, very, very into typography and do tons of studies that. So when we all read these studies and we have conferences and we talk about typefaces, but then sometimes it's random. Sometimes a designer uses a typeface. Lisa Smith redesigned the Chobani yogurt identity, and everybody started using that type. It just, sometimes it resonates with people, with other designers, and it just becomes something that everybody, oh, that's a fabulous typeface. And then serifs go in and out of vogue. It's a very funny world. Most of the research is done. There are research firms that do feed big companies and branding studios, but a lot of it is done by people like me, by academics who write papers, and then there's just beauty of form. New typefaces are designed every day. We tend to use the foundries. They're called type foundries that have the best designers, so we know we're getting an aesthetically pleasing face, something that's balanced, and the proportions are really, really important, and how they affect you, whether we know it or not, they do affect you, the proportions of a letter form. So we do study all of that.
Yeah, I was reading a book on decision science and about the framing effect. So just having something against in a different jar, for example, made it more attractive. It was just discovered by accident. But I guess it's the whole thing, isn't it? It's often not just the typeface. It'll be the typeface, the colors, and the whole combination together just sort of works better than something else.
Absolutely. And it's very funny when you say that, because I'll often show, when I work with people, when I did more design in the past, now I do more consulting, but I would often say to clients, are there any colors you hate?
Mm-hmm.
And I would just avoid that color palette and look for colors that were still appropriate to the brand. Because if you showed somebody something in green and they just, you know, mm-hmm. their mother made them wear green,
yeah.
and you show them the exact same thing in blue, it'll work. Uh-huh. Color is very funny that way, and it can really, you're right, it can really change the feeling, and it just gets people emotionally in a way and on their own taste levels. And I don't let taste dictate it, mm-hmm. but I do want to make sure the client buys it.
Yeah.
And it's still appropriate, but you're right, it is context. And it's also, does it work out of doors? Does it work on screen? Does it work on a business card? Does it work on paper? Where are people going to see it mostly? When we see color on screen, there's light coming through, and so it's brighter and more beautiful, and then it's printed and it looks different because of the paper quality. So right now, because of COVID, there's a paper shortage, and we're getting really, you know, some of the books that are being printed now are printed on cheap paper. I mean, it just changes everything.
Yeah, I was asked recently by a client. He had a logo for a very descriptive name, and then the name wasn't going to work, so he chose a more distinctive name, but he wanted the same sort of visual look to be used with that name, and he got a designer to create it for him. And now he's wanting to know, you know, should he get copyright clearance? But he's rethinking his whole brand. And I don't know whether to say to someone, actually, you should get a proper designer to look at this, because it was someone like on Fiverr who created something. He obviously likes it. But, you know, what should one say to people like that?
Well, he's wouldn't go to an attorney that he pays $99 to, right? I mean, you wouldn't go to a doctor you're getting what you're paying for. And really, really good designers work at really good studios. And they have great reputations, and you look up to see whether they've won awards and what other people think of their work and what their other clients say. And it's one of the reasons I wrote Strategic Creativity is so that everybody can understand what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people, as you're pointing out, don't know what to look for.
Yeah.
And today it's very easy to get a logo for $99 or less, but you're going to get something common. You're going to get something pedestrian. You're definitely not going to get something that's distinctive, because that person does not taking the time. You're paying for someone's time, essentially, and expertise. And you could get somebody who went to a two-year school, who didn't go to school, and Fiverr hired them.
Yeah.
It really is such a range, but you have to think about it as you're looking for an expert.
Yeah, but if you're trying to find a more low-cost expert who's talented, how do you identify talent, especially in something like identity design?
I think, well, that's again, I'm sorry for the self-promotion, but that's why I wrote this book, so that everybody would really understand what to look for. And I do tell people, if they are on a budget, to think about hiring a graduate student at a really in a really good program, or my book cover. I hire my own students to design. Mm-hmm. I give them a break and they design the covers. So somebody, and there are seniors in an undergraduate program. So if you go to a really good school with a good design program, you're probably going to get good bang for your buck.
Oh, well, maybe I'll suggest that to him, going to that. So just to round up, I'm wondering whether you cover intellectual property at all with your students, because for visual identity, it is so important, for example, not to choose a color that's an industry standard color, because then you're never going to be able to register that as a trademark, or, you know, not to use green if you want to be all about eco-friendly, you know, all these very common choices that people make, is impacted by intellectual property as well as presumably design. So do you cover IP at all?
We do. And it's so critical today, because the internet's the Wild West, and mm-hmm. people are taking things they think it's okay to take. And as you know, and you can speak to this much better than I can, intellectual property law is very complicated. We also teach them what not to do in terms of intellectual property.
Yeah.
And we emphasize that more, just to make sure they're not breaking the law and taking other people's intellectual property. It's so critical. And we do talk about it, but more on the what not to do side. But you're right, we should talk about the what you can do side.
Yeah, well, to own, basically, when you're dealing with brand strategy, you should be really thinking about how can this client uniquely own this, because it's a designation of origin. So your name, your identity, it's how people recognize you. So you don't want a competitor using a similar identifier. So you want to keep it unique to you, which is why there are strategies before you can register a trademark of protecting things so that other people can't use them. And then eventually, I think that's quite important to teach to branding people, because, you know, there's no education at all in IP. And I think the world has changed quite a lot, and it's more necessary now maybe than pre-internet to actually understand how IP fits into the whole picture.
I totally agree with you. And actually, my students are very interested in it. They want to know how they can own their intellectual property. And we do go over the difference between a copyright and a trademark and a patent. But it's complicated. And we just really, really make an effort to make sure they're not appropriating.
Yeah.
And they're not taking anybody else's.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, especially imagery, which, you know, you do a Google search and images come up and...
Yeah, I mean, people often think if it's on the internet, it's available in the public domain, that they can use it. There's a lot to know and not know.
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I go over one case in the U.S., Modern Dog Design fought Target and Disney. One of the designers at an apparel company took their work and flipped it and used it without permission. And that was a huge battle that became well known. And I usually show that to the students I should probably send this to you. You'd be fascinated. The judge made a decision looking at the images. Mm. The judge, who's not an expert in imagery. So I do show some case studies of appropriation.
Yes, that would be interesting. I'll add it in the show notes. And what do you think of Building Distinctive Brand Assets by Jenny Romaniuk. Is that something you use in your teachings at all?
I don't know that.
You don't know it? Oh, right. Well, you know the Ehrenberg Bass Institute in Australia, they research for big brands, and she's written this book, Distinctive Brand Assets, and it covers sonic branding and, you know, how, yeah, it's very important to branding, really, that how, you know, you can be uniquely recognized and become famous by reference to identifiers, so distinctive brand assets like color. And they did research to see which kind of identifiers are most likely to be famous for a brand. Things like characters, symbols, which are obviously very, very good for brands to have. I'm actually interested in why more of them don't have them. I mean, why would you not choose to have a character or symbol with your branding?
I think it has to do with the essence and the story and the construct, and it often gives a face to a faceless entity. So, you know, you think about an insurance company, and they often have a character because there's nothing really distinctive about an insurance company. And especially, I think people enjoy it when it becomes video or commercials or movement. Some companies are known for it. Ad agencies are known for it, like Leo Burnett agency is known for creating these characters that personify a brand, but not every brand wants it personified, or to have a creature or a character, or, you know, however you want to say it. But sometimes they'll use real spokespeople. You know, a celebrity becomes the character.
Yeah, or something like the Golden Arches M, you know, just using one of the characters or letters in a in a brand, so that you've got a shortcut to be recognized by it.
Right. Or, I think most people think of the logo mark that way, but you can have elements of the logo, as you're saying, the Golden Arches or something that works for you that way. Oh.
Well, I'd highly recommend getting Jenny Romaniuk's book. I think it's so relevant to what you do.
I will. Thank you.
Good. Well, are there any books you'd recommend? It was because I was going to ask you about recommending books that I thought about Jenny Romaniuk's book. Obviously, apart from your own, which there's, 25, very extensive. Is there anyone's book that you would recommend, or a podcast or anything?
There's a fascinating book. I don't know if he's updated it, called The Culture Code.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and I'm blanking on his name. The French, he's a French psychiatrist who wrote about branding. There's an older brand book, Emotional Branding, about making that connection. I don't know if they've updated that. Marco Bay, I think, is the author. And about the elements of an identity, Alina Wheeler wrote a really good book about.
Oh, yes, I've got her book.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed for appearing on the podcast, Robin.
My honor. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great to meet you. Nice to have met you.
Same here. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.